Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowering. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at Richmond Cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Hillary Wilder. Welcome, Hillary, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to read a little bit of your resume. One, because it's pretty gosh darn impressive.
Thank you.
And two, I think it helps people to understand a little bit about where you're coming from. You were born in North Conway, New Hampshire. Let's spend a half an hour talking about that.
I don't think you could possibly fill half an hour talking about North Conway, New Hampshire.
Right. It's tiny. You received your BA in studio art from Bates College and an MFA in painting from the University of Wisconsin in 2001. And 07, 08, I guess that's how they run it because they're grants. You received the Paula Krasner Foundation grant. So congratulations on that. That's
very
nice. Yes. And in 2006, you were a recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship in Visual Arts. In 2004, you completed a two-year fellowship as both a visual artist resident and a critical studies resident in the core program at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. What is a critical studies resident?
Well, the core program, first of all, is the residency program that's affiliated with the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. Uh-huh. And they've always had, well, not always, it's been 25 years now, they've had a lot of different types of artists coming there as visual artist residents. And then several years ago, I think maybe in like 98, 99, they started also inviting writers to be there as critical studies or curatorial residents. And I applied as both, and I was accepted as both. So I was the first and only person to ever be in the core program as a double agent. So,
she's good enough. We got to get her for both. So you were making your own work as a visual artist resident, right?
Right.
It was this sort of residency. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, she also really can teach well, too. So is that what critical studies is?
No, it wasn't a teaching fellowship. It was actually some people do it more as like a curatorial project where they, you know, invite artists and do shows. And but I think most people who have done that residency, the critical studies part of the program, have been there as writers. So I was writing some criticism. I wrote a few catalog essays for museums. So I was kind of, instead of doing like half of each residency, I really did do both. It was really busy, but really, really fun and a great opportunity. Yeah.
What came out of it that sort of grabbed you the most, you think?
As far as writing?
Or even your work?
Well, it's funny. Like, you know, during that time, I was writing some things that I thought were sort of relevant to, but sort of like tangential to painting. Like, I wrote a piece on Jeremy Blake, who at that point in time was getting a lot of recognition for doing animations that he called moving paintings.
Right. You know. Let's back up for a second. You just said an interesting word. You said moving paintings.
Yeah.
I'm clueless.
I was too. At the time I wrote that piece, you know, I was thinking about different things that were happening, like not necessarily in traditional painting, but things that were happening that seemed sort of close to painting and new media and like even the physical ways in which painting can be expanded, because that's something that I do in my own work. So, and now since then, I think there has been like a lot of interest in the idea of paintings that move. There was just an exhibition, I think, in San Diego about animated paintings. So,
well, let's talk about VCU just for a sec.
Sure.
You are teaching at VCU.
I am.
And tell us a little bit about that. When did you arrive there?
So far, so good. I started in September, and so this is just my second semester now.
Right.
And still kind of getting my bearings a little bit, but, you know, as I think everybody knows now, it's a pretty incredible school and a great program. I have an interesting mix of working with mostly sophomores and grad students.
Oh, really?
So,
wow.
Yeah, which is really fun, actually, to be able to do, like, you know, to talk to the grads, which is always rewarding and exciting. Mm-hmm. But then also to get some of the students as they're first coming in the door into the department. So,
what's the difference?
Well, there's a lot of difference. Yeah. I mean, like, really, in the earlier stages of the undergraduate curriculum, it has to be somewhat skills-based and, you know, introducing content into the work and sort of taking some of that on. And by the time they're grads, they really should be, you know, becoming themselves as artists and trying to find, like, you know, not to sound cliche, but to find their own voice in a way.
Yeah.
And to not be worrying about things like technique, which should be secondary to what it is that they're really, you know, focusing on.
So they're really, making art. Talk about the Pollack Krassner Foundation grant. What was that like for you? What did you end up doing with that? Or?
Well, I got the Pollack Krassner just this past fall, and so that was really good timing because I was getting ready to go to Iceland. I did a residency in Iceland in December.
Really?
Yeah, and then I also just did an exhibition in Seattle. So,
do you know that Iceland's having problems with their economy?
Are they?
Isn't that bizarre?
Well, they got plenty of my money when
I was
there.
Just thought I'd reject that. Yeah.
I guess things are tough all over.
So things are tough all over. You know, I mean, if we're having trouble in Iceland, my goodness.
Yeah.
So there you were in Iceland.
There I was in Iceland. And so the Pollack Krassner sort of, you know, helped facilitate both of these big projects. Mm-hmm. And in Iceland, I didn't actually have an exhibition proper. I was in a group show when I was there. But I was working on a lot of different things, like the... Even though, like, mostly I make paintings, I also do other things. And so during the time I was in Iceland, I was actually editing a video that ended up being in the show in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I was working on some photographs that also ended up in that exhibition.
Right.
So the Pollack Krassner helped, you know, to sort of take care of the funding for that trip. And then also to do some of the things that I had to do for the Seattle exhibition.
How'd you like working in Iceland?
It was amazing. I was there in December. So, you know, as you likely know, you know, there's really almost no daylight.
Right.
So that made for an interesting experience. It's kind of like being on the moon.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful and strange.
Well, I kind of like the night, so maybe I would like
it. I do too.
You know, I'm sort of an evening person.
That's
so
what I told
sort of
people.
Like evening all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
And the weather was horrendous, like sideways freezing rain coming off the ocean.
Lord.
But it was kind of like, you know, extreme art making.
Yeah.
So it was.
Well, talk about what you did there. What you did video there?
I did video. I shot some video that actually the piece that was in Seattle is primarily an audio piece, but there's a video component to it. It exists as a video.
Uh-huh.
So I shot the video there, and I also traveled around a little bit and you know did some day tours to the geysers and things like that and took images. You know, partly because a lot of the work I do in painting is so closely related to the idea of landscape and what landscape can or can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of always been really what I'm considering, you know, and thinking about the history of landscape and whether or not like that has transformative power, you know, either the immediate experience of landscape or the mediated experience of landscape through paint. And I thought it was interesting when I went to Iceland, everyone kept saying, oh, it's going to change your life. It's going to change your life. And I was like, well, God, what if it doesn't? It's kind of a tall order. Like, what if I fail and going to Iceland doesn't change my life? So then like that became like that again is sort of like almost like a reiteration of that, you know, like, well, what if I get to this place? And
so your name used to be Susan Smith, right? Before you went to Iceland.
Right. Exactly.
It changed your life.
And so then like looking at these things like, you know, the waterfalls, the geysers that are supposed to, you know, kind of stir up these incredibly like, you know, transcendent feelings, you know, was kind of like a sort of a laboratory experiment in how this stuff really works.
Right.
So that's why that was
transcendent experience?
Not so much for me.
No. Interesting.
And so I actually made a piece about that for the show. I mean, I thought it was beautiful, but
that's interesting.
But I've had experiences that to me feel more sort of like fundamentally moving in different locations. And like I was talking to a friend of mine who did the same residency in Iceland about a year before me. And she really did have this experience of having it like just change the whole way she thinks about making her work and her life. And I've had that happen in another location. And so
where did it happen with you?
What happened with me was in a little town called Bernie, Texas, where I lived for 6 months.
Really?
Yeah, I lived
was
on
it
a
like
ranch.
Flat and...
It was hilly. It's in the hill country just south of Austin. Uh-huh. And I had like wild pigs running across my yard.
Really?
And you know, if it's even a yard, it's this huge ranch. And, you know, like cows licking the windows.
Did you know it when you got there? I mean, was there a feeling? Was there? I'm getting out there now, but was there an intuitive feeling that you went there and you went, yeah, this is.
A little bit. At first, I was a little bit scared because out there, you know, I had no phone
service.
Because all
these pigs chasing you around, right?
Well, yeah, potentially. There's coyotes and
talking about life-changing experiences. You know,
but it really
was the last time you got chased by a wild pig, right?
Well, it doesn't happen to most people every day. But so that was the experience that for me was, you know, kind of made me change the way I feel about the world, which is like, I know maybe a slightly cheesy thing to say, and it's hard to
about that, because I think that's
a point on
that's,
it. But
yeah, but that's really interesting.
Well, it was for me, and like,
I mean, because how many, you know, I mean, I don't know that a lot of people, you know, a lot of us get stuck in our lives and live in the same place, do the same thing, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're saying that you go to a new physical location, right?
Yeah.
And Iceland was supposed to have been this transcendent experience that had some impact, but not so much. But then you go to this little place in Texas that transforms what? What happened? What?
Well, first, I was
help
in Texas
understand.
First. This is almost 2 years
yeah,
ago.
Right, exactly.
And I think that... there is something about the isolation of it, you know, the fact that I could be there and not have phone service or internet service, you know, so there's no outside world. And I had a beautiful studio where I had, you know, incredible views, like in three directions of the landscape and the sunset and all these things that, you know, again, I feel like I'm always sort of questioning, although not being deliberately critical of those things as ideas. But I'm always sort of questioning, well, how, you know, can this make a person feel different or better about the world? And and in Bernie, something about the quietness of it, you know, it felt like almost my own like little Walden or something, you know.
And how long were you there?
I was there for about 6 months.
By yourself?
Yes, although I also, I was teaching in San Antonio and I kept an apartment in Houston, so I was in Houston most weekends. So, but during the time I was in Bernie, it was really, you know, kind of like this little private world for me. And I made really, for me, like I thought really successful work and just felt very fulfilled out there in a way. And so in going to Iceland, you know, people kept saying, oh, it's going to change your life. And it didn't happen the same way, but it did for somebody else that I know. And so it's kind of like, you know, you
can't
script those
things. Well,
it almost
seems like there's a different, there's a different aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's
very,
part of it.
Very different,
Well, I told people, it's like, well, you know, I kind of grew up in the wintry north, so maybe that doesn't have as much resonance for me, you know.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, the Hudson School of Illumination I had mentioned, I think, before the interview, and you do, you talk a lot about landscapes.
Yes.
And you work a lot with landscape. And, I mean, put somebody in Iceland, and it's nighttime, and there's, you know, sort of a geyser. I mean, where's the light? I mean... I can't imagine you coming to life in a place that doesn't have a lot of light.
Yeah, that maybe that's a good point. I mean, the light is, you know, few and far between. There, like, you know, it's like watching the sun come up one in the afternoon is can be sort of breathtaking. But you're right. I mean, it's just it's a different kind of place that. Which isn't to say that I didn't like appreciate it. I mean, I loved my time there, and I want to go back. But it wasn't for me that kind of like. Like life-changing experience that I think people have.
In your painting, you were talking about locations changing, changing your life, changing the work of your life, and I don't know, you know, transformative. I think you said power. Can you talk about that some more?
Well, I think so.
I mean, you know, but let me put it another way. Someone who maybe doesn't know much about art looks at a landscape and they say, well, that's a nice picture of a landscape. Okay. Now, first of all, your pictures, do you think of them more as representative pictures of landscape, more abstract pictures of landscape? Do you?
They're a little bit of both. I mean, like they certainly are recognizable as landscapes. So, you know, they're representational in that regard, but they're not of any particular locations. It's not as though I'm working from photographs or working from real life. All the paintings I make come out of my own head. So,
So
I don't work from source material.
Okay.
But, you know, you were talking about the idea of somebody looking at a landscape and saying, oh, nice landscape. I think that for a lot of people, it's more than that. And I,
well,
I'm
that's
not,
what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. You know, it's like, well, nice picture. Yeah, exactly.
And,
go
and
ahead,
sometimes,
talk about
like,
that some more.
What I wonder is, you know, and the same thing might be true also of landscapes in real life, like whether that really is an absolutely like pure, genuine experience or whether that's somehow something that we've learned, you know, that,
what do you mean?
That the romantic landscape has like this sort of like awe inspiring sort of seductive power over us that people stand in front of like Frederick Church paintings and the Met and go, oh, and I don't really know if that's because, I mean, the paintings are fantastic. I feel that way about them. So I don't mean in any way to try to diminish their importance. But I wonder if there's something about that that's also learned, you know, like.
I was at the Grand Canyon years ago, 35 years ago, maybe. And everybody was whispering.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I looked around and noticed everybody started talking like this.
Right.
This big hole in the ground, and they're all whispering.
And so maybe there's something going on there. Yeah, maybe that is like a genuine thing because, you know, it's so infrequent in our world, especially now that we come across these things that are so incredible and monumental in that way. But maybe like as far as the painted image, maybe that's something that somehow we learned was to have that reverence for that, or to think that it has a kind of power that's almost like quasi-religious.
It has to do with the light, though, don't you think?
Yes.
The way the light's used?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But and that's another thing, too. Yeah. It's like that as a vocabulary. If you look at, you know, again, like Church or Bierstadt or, you know, Cole, any of these painters from the 19th century, it's like the way that they're painted. I'm thinking especially now of Bierstadt. We frequently has like the sun like behind mountains and it's this warm glow that comes from behind.
Right,
it's that is like metaphor for some sort of like religious sort of illumination, you know, like is, I think,
but what saves
obvious.
It from just being sort of, do you know, I mean, you might not be able to answer this, but from just being sort of a sentimental kind of,
I don't know. I mean, like, but that's the question.
It is interesting, isn't
it? You know, because now, like, that same kind of,
like Thomas Kincaid, right?
Right.
Okay? You know? I can't, similar is the really wrong word to use here. But in a way, similar. I mean, in a way,
because
his
is
so much more sentimental and so much, you know, less.
Right, because they're little, like, cabins with, like, little.
But people love them.
Of course they do.
You know? And are they wrong to love these?
I don't know.
You know?
I mean, I kind of feel like, I kind of feel like, you know, it's the same language again. It's like, you know, we look at Bierstadt and there's this light coming from behind the mountain. And now, like, that same kind of motif has been used in, like, religious posters,
right,
that have, like, little sayings at the bottom about, you know, like, feeling the light or whatever, or Thomas Kincaid. It's something that, like, Jasper Johns would say, it's things the mind already knows.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
It's like, it's almost like a symbol. It's this thing that just, you know, that we respond to. And I think that in the case of maybe someone like Thomas Kincaid, that's a little bit exploitative, you know, that it's being used very deliberately to that end.
Right.
So then, you know, it becomes a matter of whether that can ever be genuine again. And I guess for me, I have to believe that it can be and it will be. The use of this kind of light as a motif in different works, you know, how, you know, I mentioned Bierstadt and Cole and all those guys. And then I
went ahead and said Thomas Kincaid.
Yeah, which
you
is...
But
that's,
and left, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you don't understand. I'm out of here. No, but that's the thing. It's like, you know, again, like there are these, you know, certain works where there's that kind of light used that are taken seriously and, you know, that are part of, you know, this very important history in painting. And then there are religious posters that use, like, you know, the sort of sunset photograph.
Sure.
There's Thomas
first
Kincaid.
Last day of the first day of your life or whatever that is.
Yeah, exactly. There are many different ones like that. And so I guess, you know, I'm kind of interested in these things that are supposed to maybe be a little bit corny, but that I still have to believe have a little bit of real resonance with people. I mean, I feel the same way about music, you know, like the video I just made has to do with like love songs from the 70s,
really?
Which, you know, is like
corny.
My favorite kind of music.
Yeah.
And so,
well, are you talking about disco?
No, I'm talking about like, you know, the age
the
of
Bee
like
Gees
the,
kind of,
no, the bearded sensitive songster.
Oh, okay. Know? All right. Okay.
So, okay. And you know, again, like that's the kind of music that people who like it at this point in history usually like it with some sort of like winking irony, you know, and for me, I genuinely do like that, just as I genuinely like landscape painting. So that's why I'm never trying to be too critical of these.
Yeah. You said earlier, you didn't want people to perceive your work as a send up of the Illuminist work, a sort of a postmodern send up of, you know,
exactly.
Ironic send up, I guess, of.
Well, I think that that's, you know, the danger whenever you're alluding to any kind of, you know, theme in art history is that, you know, the expectation on some people's part is that somehow you're mocking that or you're putting some clever spin on it. And that's really not where I'm coming from. I think that I want to use some of the same techniques and some of the same kind of idioms in that.
Right.
But in a way that's more contemporary and that's more mine.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it certainly isn't meant to be like this sort of like neither finger wagging in critical in that sense, nor to be sort of like, as I said, sort of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and, you know, and kind of making fun
of it. Who was the artist you mentioned earlier on who had talked about it? Did you say Jasper Johns?
Or? Well, I was talking about Johns and that, like Jasper Johns wrote about how people respond in a certain way to things the mind already knows.
That was it.
That's a quote of his, and that's why he made certain choices as far as, like, you know, signs and symbols and things that exist in our popular culture.
So you think there are things? Do you think there are things the mind knows that art reveals?
Even
though the mind isn't cognizant of it, I guess would be the way.
Yeah.
Which is why it kind of keeps expanding.
Why art keeps expanding. Right.
That there is a knowing, some sort of global, intuitive, you know, I mean, I guess Jung called it the subconscious, but, you know, something at work there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you think about even that phrase, things the mind already knows, it's that there are these either, you know, what John's was talking about were very specific signs and symbols. What I'm talking about is more like an aesthetic, you know, like the aesthetic of the romantic, which I still think that is something that people respond to because there's probably like some sort of like hopefully some sort of innate sense of appreciation for landscape, but also definitely this like culturally conditioned appreciation for it that I think comes from our visual culture, having seen these paintings and these other types of landscape that exist in our visual world.
Right. Earlier we were talking about life transforming events.
Right.
And when you went to Iceland, I guess you had a friend who had gone, and it really did transform her way of, I guess, of what? Of making art? When you say life-transforming event, what does that mean? We talked about it in terms of Texas with you.
Yes.
What does that mean?
You know, I guess it depends on the person, too.
Right.
You know, I guess I can't really speak to somebody else's transformation, you know.
I was asking you.
if you could talk about that other person that was in Iceland. But I think that, you know, especially for an artist, I imagine, it has to be something that has an impact on your work and maybe even changes the course of your work or what you want for your life or your way of making. And so, as I mentioned before, you know, my friend Katrina had this experience in Iceland that really was, for her, something that inspired her in a way, to use sort of a cliche term. And for me, it was a little bit less so. And so that was where I started making this piece that ended up in Seattle. It's called Three Sunsets That Changed My Life and Two That Didn't. And what the piece is, it's a print that actually has like five photographs of different landscapes in it. And some of them, one was taken in, actually I think maybe two were taken in Iceland, and then the other ones were taken elsewhere. And so they're kind of cobbled together in this print, and the viewer has no way of knowing which are which,
right.
You know.
Right.
And that's what the piece is about, ultimately, is like that subjectivity of experience that you know, not only does the viewer not know which ones are which,
right. But
that even if I told you, it wouldn't really make any difference,
right.
You know,
right. Because
you're not going to feel what I felt. But it's amazing how frequently, you know, when I was showing the piece in Seattle, people really wanted to know, well, which ones, like some sort of puzzle they couldn't figure out. And it's like, well, that's the point, is if I told you, you still wouldn't get what I, you know, I can't script that experience for you, you know, so...
Yeah.
So that was the piece that ended up being a container kind of for that idea, was that there's no way I can ever tell you about.
Did
my
it change
life,
you?
Changing
was
experience.
It changing you because of the visual experience? Was it a tactile experience? Was it an auditory experience? Was it a sort of this full body kind of experience? I mean,
kind of all
do,
of
you know
those
what I'm
things.
Saying?
Yeah,
I'm thinking about, you know, people who've like driven across the country.
Yeah,
you know, and you talk to them about it, and they go, "Yeah, it's really big."
Yeah,
you know? And you kind of wonder, you know. I mean, isn't it interesting that you can go someplace and it transforms your life?
Right.
I mean, I find that fascinating.
I think a lot of people have that experience, but it's one of those things that, you know, it's kind of like painting the landscape. It's something that has become like such a, like almost like a known quantity that people almost don't believe that it's true as far as like transformative experience, you know, mm-hmm, like if you say like, yeah, I went on this road trip for 3 months and I came back a changed person. It's yeah, sure you did.
Yeah, right.
No, I mean, it's kind of like, it's just something that people almost think is like, you know, like sarcastic at this point.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it's hard to talk about. Like, again, like this being one of those things that, that I believe in, but I kind of feel like in an intellectual sense, I shouldn't, like I should be smarter than that, than to think that that really happens to people.
Now, what about video? Let's talk about that a little bit. A painter who makes video and is fascinated with video?
Yeah, well, you know, the video that I just made, as I said before, like really started it as an audio piece, taking on some of the same kinds of things that I was talking about with the paintings, you know, the idea of the romantic and the subjective and the inexpressibility of certain emotions. And as I said earlier, you know, I'm really interested in like kind of like weepy love songs from the 70s.
Right.
And going through my catalog of weepy love songs from the 70s, I was listening to a couple of Eric Clapton songs that I soon discovered were pretty much the same song.
Right.
Bell Bottom Blues he wrote for Patti Boyd when he was in love with her and she was still married to George Harrison. And then Wonderful Tonight he wrote for Patti Boyd after they had been married for several years and they were in some sort of wedded bliss.
Right.
But if you really listen to both of those songs from a musical theory standpoint, they're essentially the same song.
Right.
In terms of like tempo, chord structure, like they're nearly identical. And so here's somebody expressing, you know, the sort of like unrequited love, brokenheartedness, I'm going to go be a heroin addict, you know, I can't stand how much I love you. 6 or 7 years later, it's like, yeah, we live together and everything's cool. And it's still the same song. And so what the audio piece was actually like splitting those songs apart and reorchestrating them as one piece.
Uh-huh.
So in the audio, it's actually both those songs playing together. It's almost like a call and response to each other. And and they sound like one song. It doesn't sound as like there's this dissonance between the two of them. Yeah, I mean, I felt like it needed some sort of like visual component that would be also like a metaphor for the same thing. And that's what I was shooting in Iceland was there's this strange phenomenon that happens where, you know, the waves are coming in from the ocean, like from the west, but then the wind typically comes from the east, so the wind pushes the waves back, so they get caught, you know, they're trying to get to the shore, but they get pushed back and forth and back and forth, and so that's the video element that I used for this piece, where it actually looks like, it looks like the video being played backwards, but it's actually in real time, it's the wind pushing the waves back.
Really?
And so that, you know, serves as a pretty direct metaphor for what I'm talking about with the audio, and the piece is called Breaking Even, because I figured that's kind of what Clapton did, was like heartbreak and then wedded bliss. It's like, well, okay, well, now we just landed in the middle pretty much, so so that's what the video does as well.
Are they still married?
No, they divorced pretty soon after that, so... I guess you just can't win, you know?
good old life, really.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, this is hard to believe, but unfortunately, we are just about out of time. Do you have a website?
I do.
What is it?
HilaryWilder.com.
Spell it.
HilaryWilder.com.
Okay, great.
So that's Hillary with one L, not
one
Hillary
L.
Clinton, who's messing up my
messing
here.
Up, messing up your image, I know.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you again on the radio for lunch next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's a radio for the rest of us.